Welcome back to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here, John Curly away today. He should be back tomorrow. And Felix Bunnell filling in very ably. You know, Felix, we love to kid you here at the station about how excited you can get about things like old beer cans and musty, dusty archives. I mean, it's like shooting fish in a barrel, but still, I've got to give you credit. Today really is a day worthy of celebration. And you know, in order to mark that celebration, we're going to bring to the show a man even more involved than Felix Bunnell in today's good news about our National Archives at Sandpoint. That's Attorney General Bob Ferguson. Welcome to the Tom and Curly Show, Bob.
Hey, thanks so much, Tom, and thanks to Felix, really, for daylighting this really important issue. We couldn't have done it without him.
Say that one more time.
Yeah, pull that clip. So, Bob, can you, first off, just sort of explain what's happened and why it matters?
Sure. So in Seattle, we have, as Felix has reported many times, what's called the National Archives. And these are really the DNA of our region. All sorts of documentation and the history of our region are located there. That can be critically important for tribes. Drafts of tribal treaties are there. If you had a family member who was caught up in the Chinese Exclusion Act, documentation related to that might be there. Or if you had a family member who was interned during the internment of Japanese Americans, they would have documentation there, all sorts of records. Bottom line is the federal government decided to go ahead and move those archives without any public process at all. It really was outrageous. Felix was the first one to report on it. Then my team and I got busy filing a lawsuit to put a stop to it. We prevailed in court, and the news now is the federal government is capitulating and saying they're not going to sell the property.
Fantastic. I think this, what I liked most about this, maybe not most, but especially in these times, is there seemed to be bipartisan support for our local region to hold on to this. How did you help make up or put together that coalition?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, the lawsuit we filed was a coalition of dozens of tribes, of community organizations, historical organizations, and individuals who really came together because, let's face it, if you're doing research on your family's history, if you're doing research on your tribal history, if you start doing a research project related to the area, it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. My late father was a Dan Evans Republican. He loved the archives. He went there all the time. He dragged all of his seven children out to the archives. Okay, so I've been there myself. He was on a first-name basis with all the staff there, Murray Ferguson. And so I really grew up with an appreciation for that history, which frankly is so central to who we are. And it really was outrageous how these obscure agencies back in D.C. who know nothing about who we are or what these documents mean to us, we're just going to take these documents and move them literally 1,000 miles away, and they're not digitized. You can't access them any other way. And so I was really proud to be part of a team that filed a lawsuit that put a stop to this.
Now, okay, it's a big victory to end the sale, and it's officially over. It's not going to happen. But everybody knows, or a lot of people know, that building does need support to fix the roof, to fix the HVAC and everything. And I think personally you could do a lot more with the materials there to have sort of public programming. A lot of people didn't know about this building even existing until a year ago when the news broke that it was threatened. What has to happen next for that the future of it to be secured and to be brighter than it's been?
Yeah, it's a great question, because this letter that this federal agency wrote saying they're not going to sell the property, it left out something very important. The letter does not say that they won't move the archives. They're simply saying they're not going to go forward now with the sale. So what needs to happen, Felix, to answer your question, is the political solution. Our federal members of Congress and from Washington State and this area need to work with these federal agencies and the Biden administration to come up with a solution to either fix up that facility, which needs repairs, or frankly find a new facility here in Washington State that can house these records in a safe way. So there is still work to be done, but this is an important victory. But again, this agency is not committing at this point to saying they won't move the archives altogether.
Yeah, and we got a hold of some internal communications from National Archives today where they're basically sent a word to all their employees that they're happy about this and that they're convinced they have to remain in the Seattle area and to serve this region. So, and I think that coalition that you formed, I want to talk about that a little bit more, because I had one Native American tell me this was the strongest coalition of tribes since the Bolt decision, where so many tribes who might have differences over some other issues, they at least all agree that these archives are important. And I think that group has a lot of power going forward. And it's just sort of, it's kind of interesting to see what might happen if that coalition decides to focus on improving the archives, doing the digitization, and making them more of a sort of a, I don't know, a destination for people who might not even care as much about history as someone like I do. But it just seems like there's a lot of great potential for that coalition that you put together.
I think that's right. And this coalition really was, I've been a part of, you know, more than 100 lawsuits against the federal government in my time as attorney general. What I can say unequivocally is this is the broadest coalition we've ever had by far, and not just for any federal litigation, but perhaps any litigation I've been involved in as an attorney, period. And so it is a unique group of tribes and organizations, and there is a power in that coalition, to your point, Felix. And I think that the federal government realized that they were going to lose from a legal standpoint, they're going to lose from a public relations standpoint, and candidly, they were harming tribes in a way that was really profound. And I think that testimony came through from the tribes, and no doubt, made a big, big impact in the outcome we're achieving today.
So, Bob, I've praised you for the bipartisanship of this effort, but I have to ask you a little more pointed question. Do you think that this resolution would have happened today, as much as it has been resolved, if Donald Trump was still president as opposed to Joe Biden? How important was who was in the White House to this decision, do you think?
You know, it's a really good question, and Felix and I have talked about this in the past. It's always been my sense that this was not a Donald Trump or Joe Biden thing, that these agencies are relatively obscure, okay, in the way they operate, and these are relatively obscure people who make these decisions. And candidly, I never thought it was some larger political decision that was going on. And frankly, the only reason we got the outcome today is because we filed a lawsuit, and a federal judge in Seattle about a month and a half or 2 months ago now said basically, no, what you're doing is wrong. I'm not going to allow this. And so, frankly, the letter did not come as a surprise. They were facing an imminent legal defeat. They could have either sent the letter or waited for the judge to put the final nail in that coffin. So I don't think it's a Biden thing versus a Trump thing.
Okay.
To me, it's just a distant, obscure federal agency that, frankly, didn't give a hoot about what the people out here wanted. And that's wrong. And frankly, it was also illegal. And that, at the bottom level, that's why we prevailed.
There you go. Felix?
Yeah, I mean, I do look forward to that day when the pandemic's over and we can all gather there and this sort of future of these archives can be hammered out with just beyond anyone's belief of what could have been possible in the past. It seems like it gives it new life and a new chance. And thanks for doing that big lawsuit and putting together that coalition. And I hope the congressional delegation can come through with the funding that's necessary, because the worst thing would be for this to sort of be forgotten again and then sort of come up around again in, you know, 4 or 8 years from some other administration that may not feel the same way. So
perfect.
I think that's right. In some respects, the hard work is still ahead, but appreciate that. And really, it's a credit to my legal team who spent God knows how many hours putting all this together that they did a fantastic job as usual.
And then, Bob, I always wanted to ask you as we wrap up here, is it true that you're a Blanchett High School alum?
I'm a proud 1983 graduate of Blanchett High School, and I live very close by. I can almost throw a stone at the school. I live that close. I haven't gone too far from my Blanchett roots.
Perfect, because I'm a little bit older than you. I think I graduated in 72, so like a different generation. But like, yeah, much older, yes. But I look back. So I was in all the Blanchett musicals, and I was editor of the paper. What are you most proud of your time at Blanchett High?
Well, I was most proud that when I was on the chess team, we brought the Washington State High School Chess Championship to Blanchett High School for the first time. How's that for some
very
trivia? That's great.
Congratulations.
Save the tough questions
okay.
to last.
Well, listen, thanks for coming on the Tom and Curly Show, and thanks for Felix Spinell for greasing those skids on a day that not only archivists can be happy about, but I think there should be a lot of regional, local pride in keeping the archives to ourselves. So
we're all archivists today, I like to say.
Yeah, there we go.
That's exactly right. Hey, thank you both. Really appreciate the time, you guys.
Sure. Thanks a lot. That was Attorney General Bob Ferguson on this day where we've, at least for the moment, saved our archives. That is a little concerning, disconcerting, though, Felix, that despite the good news, that there's still trouble ahead, looks like, a little bit.
Well, it's not trouble so much as opportunity. But,
there you go. That's right.
I'm confident.
Finances be damned.
It'll get sorted out. But the big threat is gone, thanks to this lawsuit from Bob Ferguson and the Office of Management and Budget pulling the plug on their misguided effort to sell what they should never have decided to sell.
There you go. Okay. Well, you can do your little victory jig during the commercial. Okay, so now moving on to more kind of national news, I guess. And it comes in the wake of we have another shooting today now in Texas. Right now, there's only one fatality, and I think four other people hit. But Joe Biden came out with his he sort of unveiled these gun control measures that he's going to handle just as sort of executive action, realizing that any serious legislation is going to take a lot more time to do. Do we have clips from him, Jacob?
We do, yeah. So there's multiple little executive orders that he's hoping to put out there. So the first one is on ghost guns.
Want to rein in the proliferation of so-called ghost guns. These are guns that are homemade, built from a kit, and include directions on how to finish the firearm. You can go buy the kit. They have no serial numbers. So when they show up at a crime scene, they can't be traced. And the buyers aren't required to pass a background check to buy the kit, to make the gun. Consequently, anyone from a criminal to a terrorist can buy this kit in as little as 30 minutes put together a weapon.
So, on the question of ghost guns, I heard, let me see, it was G. Scott asked Michael Medved on the Gene Ursula show today about how big a problem are ghost guns, that he admitted he hadn't even heard of ghost guns, and I wasn't aware of how big a problem ghost guns actually are. And again, if you're not, ghost guns are the kinds of things you can buy the parts separately and then put them together yourself, and then they have no serial number, so there's no way to trace. And I think Michael Medved said that, yeah, well, they seem to be a problem. In this research I was doing, 10,000 ghost guns were recovered by law enforcement in 2019 alone, so they must be much more readily available than tend to show up in the news.
Yeah, I'd never heard of them before. That was totally new thing for me as well. And there's always some new term coming up. And I mean, it's a strange time right now where we have obviously a Democratic president and a slim Democratic majority in Congress and Senate in particular. And it seems like Biden's just working as quickly as he can to push through, executive orders, which don't require Congress, of course, but some kind of strategy that gets through by the slimmest of margins while there's this, I don't know, I guess is it a honeymoon period for Biden after inauguration? Are we still in the Biden honeymoon phase? Is that what he's trying to take advantage of right now?
I think the whole philosophy, if we broaden this out beyond gun control, it's just his whole philosophy is his popularity is never going to be better than it is right now.
Yeah,
and that tends to be true early on. Even if you're a two-term president, you tend to get the most stuff done that you'd like to get done in that that first year or two, especially if you have a Congress on your side. The disappointing thing, one of the things that Medved mentioned is that he thinks that ghost guns are one of those things that even Republicans could come around to, that obviously the NRA, there's a lot of resistance to any kind of gun control because it's a whole camel's nose, under the tent idea. But he was disappointed that we weren't doing more, through legislation. And I do think it feels like something of a cheat to just sign executive actions. Now, every president does it, and Obama did it, Donald Trump did it, and now he's doing it because he's kind of frustrated and wants to get something done. It's one way that presidents can do something quickly. The problem is it doesn't have any lasting effect. And so, although if John were here, John would be on the opposite side of this ledger, I assume, but
his weapons during the commercial break like he normally does just to prove a point. So I'm not going to do that here in Wallingford.
That's good. But it is a sign of a kind of a limited power to do anything with the guns. And at this point, these are just, he's just calling for proposals. He's asking for his departments to come up with these situations. Do we have another clip from him, Jacob?
We do. The other one, there's extreme risk protection orders. We'll skip that one because that's, I think people understand that, but we have one locally.
Okay, ERPO.
He did talk about pistol stabilizers.
We want to treat pistols modified with stabilizing braces with the seriousness they deserve. A stabilizing brace hook and a pencil essentially makes that pistol a hell of a lot more accurate than a mini rifle. As a result, it's more lethal, effectively turning it into a short-barreled rifle. That's what the alleged shooter in Boulder appears to have done. I want to be clear that these modifications to firearms that make them more lethal should be subject to the National Firearms Act. The National Firearms Act requires that a potential owner pay $200 fee and submit their name and other identifying information to the Justice Department, just as they would if they went out and purchased a silencer for a gun.
So, it reminds me a little bit of the bump stock issue a couple of years ago,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
Fairly esoteric sort of thing, yeah. I guess, unless you really know about this stuff.
People in the know know, and none of the rest of us do. Yeah.
It's on the margins, and it gives, and Biden can do this kind of on the political margins without a big majority in Congress. Because I think he's right, I think, when he talks about a lot of voters, you know, support him more than the elected officials do, whether the Republicans in Congress versus the actual Republican voters. And I think he can sort of not exactly get away with stuff like this, but as you pointed out, in this phase, this honeymoon phase of his presidency, this is the time to try this stuff. This is the time to try to kind of create coalitions around specific issues and try to do some actual legislation, let's hope, moving forward.
Yeah, it is risky, though, when you introduce too many, you have too many things on your plate. Like right now, he's trying to get through this huge infrastructure bill and then, you know, in parts one and parts two. And then this, the more he gets on his plate, the more chances he has to alienate whatever, possibility of working together is. But
at least they're coherent policies, not just wacky ideas. You know what I mean? There's some meat behind the sizzle.
Okay, I'll take that, although just... as a proxy for John, he'd point out that a lot of these things are irrelevant to what's really problematic. There's so many guns in this country anyway that these kind of, you know, nibbling around the edges are more virtue
That's
signaling
right.
than anything
the
else.
The defeatist perspective. You're right. I'm glad you brought
there
that up.
There you go. Okay. Thanks, Felix. Thanks to Bob Ferguson. And now we turn to Tracy with the... God, I love the weather so much that I can even take bad traffic news. How's it looking out there right now, Tracy? Welcome back to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here. John Curly away for the day. He'll be back tomorrow, we presume. And Felix Pinnell doing a great job of filling in. So, you know, whenever we have a guest host on or a fill-in host, we usually like to indulge them with, something that they're... Yes. Overly interested in just
I feel that way. I feel like that has been the case today. Thank you very much.
Yep. Yes.
Appreciate that.
But in the return favor is that I'm not sure that we would be doing this next segment if John Curley was still here. But since he's not, we're going to take advantage of that fact. I, as everyone knows, I've been reviewing movies at Cairo for like nearly a quarter of a century.
Since Birth of a Nation, I think, was the first film you reviewed, right? Or maybe no, it was The Sneeze.
Exactly.
It was The Sneeze. That's right.
But the point is that every year, the climax of the year for film buffs locally is not the Oscars. I mean, there's a lot of attention to that. But the greatest time of the year is the Seattle International Film Festival. It's been going on. I see this is the 47th edition, and tonight is opening night. Last year, it was about this time. It's always traditionally in May, so it always covers the holiday weekend. It's usually the last week or two of May and the first week or so of June. And it was about this time when the festival realized last year that they weren't going to be able to pull that thing off. So we had to cancel it for the first time in its nearly almost 50-year history. So this year they are managed to bring it back. Now, it is smaller than ever. It's a shorter time period than ever, and it's all virtual, but I say, who cares? I'm thrilled that it's back. So normally, one of the things about the Seattle International Film Festival is it prides itself on being just about the longest, in terms of physical days, the longest festival maybe in the world. It's 25 days. Now, the average length of most festivals is like less than 2 weeks. It's like 10, 11, 12 days. And the fact that we had 25 days worth of it was really something. Well, this time out, we've moved it, by the way. The festival has moved from May up till to April now. I'm not sure why they did that, but it's now down to a much more manageable 11 days. Usually there are a couple of hundred feature-length films. There are about half that many offered this year. But still, that's more than plenty to try to squeeze into an 11-day festival. And if you're at all interested in getting tickets and finding out the how and the whys of the festival running virtually, just go to sif.net/festival, and they'll give you all that information. And I put together a preview kind of every year, Felix, they normally give the press like a couple of weeks advance run. They start running press screenings beforehand because that's everything's virtual. We haven't had a chance to do any of that. But I read the profiles of all 100 or so films and came up with my top 10 best hunches. So I haven't seen any of these films, but based on, you know, what I know about them and read about them, I'm recommending these 10. That list is up at mynorthwest.com on my blog /Tom Tangney if you want to get some of the specifics. But I just want to profile the fact that it is starting tonight and will run through a week from Sunday, I think, till the 18th. And I wanted to profile a couple of films. Now, one of the funny things about this is, so I picked my top 10 best hunches. And then I asked our great producer, Jacob, to, you know, pull some clips from some of the trailers. And he messaged me back and says, just for your own, educational purposes, Tom, only 2 of the 10 that you chose were in English. So we only picked trailers from 2 of the films, which is fair enough. After all, it is called the Seattle International Film Festival.
Good point. Yeah, very good.
So there are international films that I am recommending. By the way, though, I think it's a misunderstanding. There are, I would guess, maybe as many as a half of the films are still in English, at least as a general run. So if you are subtitle adverse, there's still plenty of things to look for. But just so we get in, there's one of the ones that I'm most interested in watching, and we do have a clip of the trailer from this, is a movie called Worm, W-Y-R-M, for in effect, it's like Worm. And here's, I just want to set up the premise. By the way, one of the things that sold me on this movie, again, not having seen it, was it was compared to a combination of Todd Solondz's films. I don't know, one of my favorite filmmakers, Welcome to the Dollhouse, it's probably most like, but also a movie like Palindromes, and Yorgos Lanthimos, who did this movie called The Lobster, which is equally just weird. They're just weird things. And the premise of this is, we all know that school is hard enough as it is. But now imagine a school in which shy young teens have to wear electronic collars around their necks until they engage in their first kiss. This is clearly, a satire on sexual mores in high school. It's more comic than dystopian, but it looks relatable, as all middle school and high school movies tend to do. This is a clip from the movie, one of the 10 I'm recommending from the festival, called Worm.
You are literally the last incoming freshman to complete their level 1 sexuality requirement. Typically osculation. Kissing.
You can't complete your level 1 sexuality requirement on your own.
I could get herpes.
The only way you could get herpes is if Mom had herpes.
Women love injuries. It symbolizes that you're a warrior.
Do you know how stupid you are?
Yes.
Okay, that's hard to get a sense, but it's basically about, it looks to me like it's about the kind of humiliations everyone goes through, through puberty and growing up and dealing with the high school pressures of this and that. And it's recommended at the festival level. I have high hopes for that. There are other movies. One thing I want to point out, we don't have a clip from this, but there's a movie called The Pink Cloud. And talk about prescient. This is a Brazilian movie, and it posits this mysterious pink cloud that suddenly envelops the world and forces everyone to stay inside and in place with whomever they happen to be with at the time. And this was, it's so funny because it just seems like this perfect metaphor for, oh, this is like the pandemic movie made just for us. And in the trailer they show, even though it's in Brazilian, they have subtitles, that they point out, before the trailer even begins, by the way, the script was written in 2017, and it was filmed before the global pandemic. So it's not like somebody trying to cash in on it. It looks like it raises the same kind of issues. There's a documentary about the relationship between Truman Capote and Tennessee Williams, two of these gay icons of the 20th century. Apparently, they were quite friendly, but they also saw them as rivals and were had these kind of classic up and downs. Another movie I'd like to call attention to, East of the Mountains, is a David Guterson book that is filmed by a local filmmaker, S.J. Kiro, and it stars a local actor, Tom Skerritt, who's been around forever. It's even set in Eastern Washington. That's a movie I think we should take a great pride in for all of its local significance. And then, and by the way, I went to grad school with Gunnarsson, so another reason for pride. But the festival, you know, every year the festival honors some celebrity for, you know, their work, outstanding achievement in cinema. Well, this year it's going to Tom Skerritt. Conveniently, he's a local boy now, so it won't be quite the travails of getting him to the stage. But all the panels, it's called East of the Mountains. I would also recommend that. Again, high hopes for that. I would just encourage, I know a lot of people have been stuck inside. We're still not seeing movies in theaters for the most part, especially at the festival. But if you feel at all like exploring the terrain, the Seattle Film Festival could really use your help. And I heartily endorse them from the get-go.
And when are you going to start doing restaurant reviews based on hunches, too?
It sounds like it's really
good tasty.
No. Yeah. No one would listen. My taste, I love my taste of food, but no one gives it any credit. So I don't think that'll happen anytime soon. But that is an interesting critique. Okay, anyway, it starts tonight for the next 11 days. Okay, take it away, Tracy. How are things looking now on the road? You're listening to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here. Felix Bunnell filling in for John Curly. And now we come to the time of the show. Again, thanks for filling in on such short notice, Felix. We come to the time of the show when we just look over the horizon and hope the mailman is bringing good news to us.
I'm the mailman. As you can see, I'm the mailman. Don't nobody mess with me.
I'm sure all of his federal employment records are stored there in the archives in San Diego. Yeah. So if you ever want to do some research on who the mailman is and was, go over there and wait.
He works in Elgin, Illinois, so I'd be surprised if we have the Elgin, Illinois archives.
It was so cool when he showed up at that event at the Triple Door a couple of years ago, just a surprise guest. That was the greatest moment in showbiz history for that day, probably.
You bet. Okay. So, Felix, again, you've been filling in. Hey, by the way, what do you think of his the mailman song? You know, I have Dre's on. He sometimes fills in. He thinks the song is terrible. We love it. How about you?
Oh, I love it. I used to try to harmonize with it in studio. I can actually hear myself and I can go, I'm the mailman. I do kind of a low, kind of a bass harmony thing, and it makes me feel
perfect.
Really good. Yeah.
That's more like it. Okay, so let's get a look at these letters. I'm assuming the little lady isn't around to introduce anything, Jacob. Oh, hey, thanks for showing up.
So I'll do the first one, right, about me filling in. 425 says, in honor of his win, getting the archive saved, Felix, yay.
That's right. We're all happy for Felix.
Yeah.
Okay. And then area code 206. So, Mr. Curly is playing hooky today. I bet he's chasing more mice around his estate. The one good thing about whenever John's gone, he always comes back with a good story. So, true. I assume that'll be tomorrow. Make sure you tune in.
And about those times in the past when scientists might have accidentally ended humanity, 360 says, my grandma and grandpa both worked on the Manhattan Project in Richland, Washington. Neither of them had any idea they were building bombs. Yeah, that was true of the thousands of people who worked there. They thought they were doing some kind of chemical weapon. Some of them thought that. But the whole bomb thing was, nobody knew that except just a few people.
So crazy. And Paul in the ABQ, I remember watching the Apollo missions on TV. Do you guys remember how the newscasters would explain how the capsule had to re-enter the atmosphere at just the right angle? If it came in too steep, it'd burn up due to the friction. Oh, yeah, I remember that. If it came in too shallow, it would skip off into outer space like a stone and continue on forever. By the way, you can visit the Trinity test site the first Saturday in October and in April. The last couple of openings were canceled because of COVID-19. Interesting.
Handy New Mexico travel tips from Paul and the ABQ. All right, and about the Jeopardy host tryouts that are going on, Eric Code 425 says, with Aaron Rodgers hosting Jeopardy, should we expect Ken Jennings playing quarterback for the Packers? Revenge of the Nerds.
Now that I pay to see. On the Inslee press conference, Josh in Tacoma writes in, the number of cases alone is essentially irrelevant. It has to be used along with hospitalizations and deaths. Also, it's a mischaracterization to say John has minimized the effects of COVID-19. He simply points out the fact that almost all the deaths and severe illnesses are in elderly or severely immunocompromised. The vast majority of people who have been exposed or even infected have virtually zero negative effects.
Yeah, I don't. That's not exactly true. But wait, who's that from? That's from John and Cleellum. That letter. Okay. 360 says Tom dares to question the all-wise, all-knowing, the buck definitely doesn't stop here. Inslee administration, what's the world coming to?
And area code 206. Build all the housing you want. More people will show up than you can handle. What's needed is treatment, and with that, enforcement of laws.
Sounds logical to me. And about the new jobs people, one in four people might be searching for post-pandemic, Larry in accounting chimes in and he says, yeah, if old Larry ever left Cairo, I'm sure the place would have to close down. All the ladies would be heartbroken and couldn't get any work done.
And now it is time for the letter of the day.
Tom and Curly get the best letters of any show on the station. Always have to say funny guys.
And we have to skip half of them just to get to our letter of the day. Comes from area code 206. Nowadays, Curly's got it can be a radio tool. If you do not hear got it, it means the internet is down at the cabin. And such is life in the clum.
That's all she wrote.
That's all she wrote.
Didn't write no more.
Thanks again, Felix.
She left the gloom a-hanging around my
You bet. One more to do.